Turkey's five-day truce with Kurdish forces in northern Syria officially ends tonight, although both sides have already accused the other of breaking the pact. The US President Donald Trump has once again defended his decision to withdraw troops from northern Syria.
Where is an agreement that said we have to stay in the Middle East for the rest of humanity, for the rest of civilization, to protect the Kurds? It never said that. And we have protected them. We've taken very good care of them.
That's President Trump. So how will this latest policy shift by Washington, coupled with Turkey's operations in Syria, change the geopolitical landscape? Some argue it already has, quite significantly. We brought together three leading voices on these matters. In Melbourne, Lydia Khalil is a research fellow at the Lowy Institute and a former political advisor to the US Department of Defense in Iraq. In Boston is Max Abrams, a leading expert on terrorism and professor of political science at Northeastern University. And in Washington, D.C. is Aaron David Miller, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, focusing on U.S. foreign policy, and a former State Department Middle East advisor and negotiator in both Republican and Democratic administrations. To all three of you, welcome to breakfast.
Nice to be here.
Thanks, Hamish. Good to be with you.
Aaron David Miller, let me start with you, because you've been part of writing a piece detailing what you think Trump actually gets right about Syria. What does he get right on this?
I mean, I think that the decision, and I'm certainly not defending it, shameful with respect to its betrayal of the Kurds and injurious to American national interest, however, lays bare a certain reality, politically inconvenient and correct though it may be, now embraced by two administrations, several U.S. Congresses, and the vast majority of the American public, which is that Syria is simply not a vital American national interest. And as a consequence, over the past 10 years, no administration has been willing to face up to the very difficult decisions of what would be required, and I'm not strongly arguing against this, what would be required to compete with a variety of powers on the ground, the Turks, the Iranians, the Russians, even the Assad regime, for whom Syria is, in fact, a vital national interest. So my own logic leads me to believe that nobody, frankly, should have been surprised by this decision. Instead of briefing the Kurds and encouraging them to settle up with the Assad regime, however unpalatable that may be,
we essentially
discouraged them and probably conditioned our assistance, our continued assistance over the last year or so on the fact that they would not settle up with the Assad regime. We should have known, Pentagon and State Department planners should have understood that sooner or later this president, mercurial and unpredictable, would have become very predictable and returned to what he believes is in the American national interest, which is to withdraw American forces from this, that, and the other, what he perceives to be endless and unwinnable wars.
Can I just test that proposition you're putting, though, about the strategic interest of Syria to the United States?
Sure. Sure.
Isn't it of strategic importance by virtue of the fact that it is so strategically important to, for example, Iran?
Well, that assumes, Hamish, that it's a zero-sum game. And every gain by the United States is a loss for its adversaries and vice versa. And frankly, I don't think that is correct. We are still involved in the two longest wars in American history, where the standard for victory was never could we win, but when could we leave? And I think this is not a policy that began with the Trump administration. The Obama administration was consistently and preternaturally risk-averse when it came to try to find the right balance for U.S. policy between being not in, that is, leaving Syria to the devices of everybody else, or alternatively being all in. And a sustainable policy for Syria has not yet been found. So none of this surprises me. I think it's very depressing. And I think it's a morally bankrupt policy. But even there, we have this historic tradition of betraying the Kurds and looking at them as if they were some convenient tactical fix to one of America's problems. I just think, Hamish, it's a mess. One additional point quickly. The notion somehow, and the academic literature is very, very good on this, that American credibility is now on the line. That is to say that American allies, Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, Israel,
Well, it sounds like we've just lost that line to Aaron David Miller, but I did want to bring Lydia Khalil in at this point anyway. Lydia, it's not just nationalists, populists that have argued against American involvement in the Middle East. For a long time, there has been arguments put that by intervening in the way that it does in the Middle East, it has made the problems that exist there its own. And in a sense, some of those problems are now Russia's to deal with, aren't they?
Well, you're true to point out that what's happening in Syria right now and the mercurial Trump decisions about truth withdrawal, and let's not forget, this isn't the first time that he has tried to withdraw troops. He did this last year as well, did not start with Trump. And this has long roots from the Obama administration, as Mr. Miller pointed out, but even previous to that. I think that we have set ourselves up in our problems in Syria from overlearning our strategic mistake of invading Iraq in 2003. That was a strategic error that was made by the United States and in the coalition, but particularly the United States. And we are paying the price since then for it. And subsequent administrations after the Bush administration are now overlearning our mistakes of not to become involved in the region in the destructive ways that you've alluded to there. Our strategic mistakes are part of what led to the rise of the Islamic State to begin with, and also our ultimate decision not to address the problem of the Assad regime and not to commit our ground forces in Syria in order to do so and to eschew a policy of regime change has set up very narrow and very limited policy options for us in Syria right now. When we first decided that our only goal in Syria is to counter the Islamic State, that has significantly narrowed our options to deal with the structural issues in Syria, in the region that gave rise to the Islamic State to begin with.
Can I bring you in at this point, Max Abrams? Obviously, it sounded when Trump made this decision like these American troops were going to be going home. They won't be. They'll just be redeployed next door to Western Iraq to continue US operations against ISIS. What's your view of what happens to ISIS now? I mean, there have been very significant gains made against them. Are those gains at risk now?
They are at risk for a number of reasons. I mean, for one, the Kurds, specifically the Syrian Democratic Forces, which are mostly made up of Kurdish fighters, they've been our main ground forces against Islamic State. And now the SDF has to worry about the Turks. And so that weakens our counterterrorism. Furthermore, there are several ISIS prisons, which are in northern Syria, and they're at risk. There have been several reports of some of the ISIS fighters and their families where they've already been freed up. And then on top of that, when you look at the composition of the Turkish forces, an argument can be made that they are ISIS tinged. Some of these fighters are not all that different than ISIS. And so you have these radical jihadists, some of them coming in to northern Syria. And so for all of those reasons,
which is essentially the argument put by the Turks about the reason for them wanting to do this.
Well, I just want to actually, if you don't mind, respond to what the previous guest said about how we overlearned the lesson from Iraq. I actually disagree with everything that she said. One of the reasons why the Iraq war comes up so much, I think, is because the U.S. has learned so little. The problem with Iraq, of course, is that we engaged in regime change and we created a bigger terrorism problem, as well as sowed all sorts of destruction to the local population. And then, not that long after that, we toppled Gaddafi in Libya, which also had a really negative effect on the local population and fanned the terrorism problem. In Syria, it's true that the U.S. military did not do everything possible to remove Assad. But make no mistake, there was a lot of regime change efforts going on. This was the largest clandestine operation in U.S. history, where the U.S. poured billions of dollars into rebels. And when you ask them what it is that their main goal was, they were very clear. It was absolutely regime change. Kerry said the goal was regime change. Hillary Clinton's main advisor, Sullivan, admitted the goal was regime change. Now, again, we didn't do everything possible for that to happen.
Max Abrams,
can I just pull you up on that, though? Very extreme rebel groups, and it extended the Civil War.
Yeah. Can I just pull you up on that, though? Because notwithstanding everything you said, it's very clear that those attempts, for much of the time, were very half-hearted. It always seemed unclear about how committed the United States was to whatever its stated strategy was at any given time. And couldn't that therefore be interpreted as the reaction to the Iraq experience?
Yes, I do think that the way it was handled was informed by the Iraq experience. For example, it's no longer palatable for the U.S. to say, we want regime change because Iraq was such a disaster. So instead, we do it in all sorts of more subtle ways. In Libya, you'll recall, the explicit goal was not regime change. But of course, secretly, that was the goal, and Hillary Clinton celebrated when Gaddafi was killed. Similarly, in Syria, we can't openly say that the goal is regime change. So instead, we funded tens of thousands of fighters, both local and foreign fighters, who they said the goal was regime change. So I think that I look at what's happened over the past couple weeks, and there's a tremendous amount of irony. And that is that Turkey is using a lot of people from the Free Syrian Army, and they now are committing war crimes against Kurdish areas. And the media establishment is condemning these fighters for acting in this inhumane way against the population. However, for the vast majority of the war, the sort of the mainstream foreign policy establishment, including in the media, was pro-rebel. And these are exactly the same rebels that the U.S. and the rest of the international community had been supporting. 21 of the 28 groups that Erdogan is using, which are committing war crimes against the Kurds, are U.S.-backed.
So, Lydia Khalil, I want to bring you back in here. Given Australia's connection to all of this, what do we do? How do we reshape our policy to reflect all of the things that we've just described?
Well, clearly a lot of this policy is being driven from Washington, and as a key ally in the fight against the Islamic State, Australian policy is being led by what's happening in Washington.
So we just follow suit.
Well, in a certain sense, but we have our own considerations here in Washington, in Australia, that we have to take a look at and start to evaluate based on some of the chaotic policy that's being played out back in the United States. And here I'm thinking specifically of what to do with the Australian women and children who are in camps in Syria, and whether or not we are going to decide to repatriate them. Because the longer the instability goes on in Syria, and the more that this policy confusion goes forward, the more that the conditions of chaos can give rise to potential for Islamic State resurgence. And as Mr. Abrams said previously, a lot of these camps and prisons are at risk of being breached and having detainees escape who are associated with the Islamic State. So that is a key consideration, I think, for Australia. What to do with these women and children who are in these camps, and whether we decide, given all of the confusion and uncertainty that's happening in Syria now, whether we take on some of the risks of potentially repatriating them and trying them here and dealing with their reintegration back here, or leaving them there to become potentially part of an Islamic State resurgence and further chaos there. I think that's a key decision point for the Australian government right now.
Aaron David Miller, I think we've got you back on the line. What are the downsides globally of allowing Russia to manage whatever happens in Syria next?
Well, here's another one, Hamish, that I guess I would be a challenger of the conventional wisdom here. Yes, the Russians have won. Yes, there is a victory. Of that, I'm absolutely clear. But the reality is, what have they won? They preside over a broken country, which will take decades and billions of dollars to heal and restore. They are shackled with a regime that is dependent on them and yet profoundly entitled, with a weak military and a record of mass killing and war crimes that is going to guarantee fundamental conflict, hatreds and sectarian tensions between Sunnis and the Alawis for years to come. They are now in the middle of a Kurdish, Syrian, Turkish imbroglio that they have taken on responsibility for managing. So, you know, in my own view, since I am persuaded that of the three core critical interests that the United States has in the Middle East, number one, preventing the emergence of a regional hegemon with a nuclear power. Number two, preserving access to Middle East oil, even though we're freeing ourselves from Arab hydrocarbons. Oil trades in a single market and is still critically important to the world economy. And finally, preventing another galactic attack on the homeland. And here, when Joe Biden said the other night, a man who I admire and respect, that ISIS is coming here, I would only say to the former vice president that the vast majority of terror attacks that have been carried out against my fellow citizens have been carried out by permanent legal residents or U.S. citizens of the United States. If there's an argument to be made for sanctuary, Afghanistan's a sanctuary, Iraq's a sanctuary, Syria's a sanctuary, fair point. But in practical terms, America has become a sanctuary. And I think we're doing our best, frankly, and so is this administration, to alienate the 3 million American Muslims in this country whose cooperation we essentially need. So, you know, I don't see American vital national interests being threatened fundamentally in Syria. I'm not happy about the situation. I think the president's move was shameful and injurious to American interests. But the cri de coeur sitting in Washington among the chattering classes here, you would have thought that Syria is now the fulcrum of Western civilization against which the United States has to somehow, you know, defend itself against the Russians and the Iranians and the Assad regime.
Can I bring Lydia Khalil in on this, though? Because I'm interested to hear your thoughts on whether you think that it's now relatively inevitable that we're going to see the Assad regime rehabilitated internationally, because that's ultimately really the only option.
Well, given the uncertainties in Syria right now, it's difficult to say what the ultimate options will be. That's certainly been the goal of Assad regime and his allies. I think the move by President Trump to withdraw forces from Syria has pushed that prospect along, certainly. But conditions in Syria right now, after a period of relative stability, have reopened up again. And I would just like to make this point about some of the legacies of our policy as well. People have been saying that it was President Trump that had abandoned the Kurds by this decision. And in the most clear-cut formulation, that's technically true. However, by setting up our partnership with the Kurds, encouraging their activism for autonomy within Syria, ran up against our known and understood positions of Turkey, who would inevitably have seen this as a provocation, as a threat. And our policies were not adequate enough in order to address this. So I think it is important to go back and to address some of those legacies. In terms of Assad, certainly he's coming out as a winner, at least in the short term, from this decision. It has allowed him to move into the most stable parts of Syria, because the Kurds have had to reluctantly come to some sort of accommodation with the Assad regime and Assad forces in order to blunt any type of further Turkish incursion. So that's a key win for him. It has emboldened Russia within the Syrian conflict, which is also a key ally of Assad. And so this has really been a big own goal on the part of the United States, at least in the short to medium term.
Lydia Khalil, Max Abrams and Aaron David Miller, really appreciate the time that all three of you have given to us this morning and certainly provided some insight for all of us. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.